Hi, everyone, and apologies for my voice. I just got back from being 2 weeks sick. I'm glad that you guys can make it, and hopefully more will join us. Before starting, I do want to thank the Horizon community, which is the Israeli Space Agency's community of space educators, for their support of this event. And today we have a very interesting guest with us, Mr. Paul Szymanski. Paul, great having you with us today.
Sure. It's a delight for me, actually.
And the first time, as you said, in Israel for you. Right. Hopefully not the last. A few words about Paul. So Paul has been conducting military operations research analysis for the past 44 or 49 years. I don't remember.
It'll be 49 next year.
Wow. For the United States Air Force, Navy, Army, and Marines. The last 41 years have been exclusively in outer space program analysis, management, and development of space warfare, theory, policy, doctrine, strategies, tactics, and techniques. He has worked with the Air Force, with the Air Staff at the Pentagon, the Space and Missile Systems Center in Los Angeles, and the Air Force Research Labs in Albuquerque, New Mexico, in Rome, in New York, in Dayton, and Ohio, along with his experience in operational field testing of missile systems at China Lake in California. Paul holds a bachelor's degree in physics, mathematics, and logic, and a master's degree in experimental physics from Carnegie Mellon. Paul also manages a space warfare discussion group in LinkedIn, and that's a big and interesting group. So if this is something that interests any of you, reach out to Paul and talk to him about that. Paul, the topic of your presentation is, or at least what I asked you to talk about, because you have like tons of presentations and topics, I asked you to talk about how to fight and win space wars. And I also asked you to talk a bit about the software that you design that's called SWAT, which is not the SWAT that most of us know from business school. This is space warfare and analysis tools. So hopefully we'll talk a bit about that. And we have about 60 minutes for the presentation itself, and then some time for questions from the audience. And you know, if people stay on, we can continue and talk even more. So Paul, the stage is yours. You can share your screen whenever you want. You have access to it. And I'm going to mute myself and let you do the talking. Thank you very much, Paul.
Okay. Let me see about sharing my screen. Okay. Can you guys see my PowerPoint slides?
Yes, we can.
You should be now. Okay. Again, my name is Paul Szymanski. Good evening, good afternoon, wherever you guys happen to be. I think there were some people in France who were going to be signing up. It's actually 10 a.m. in Albuquerque, New Mexico. It's the United States. Some people think it's in Mexico. But it's the land of enchantment, they call it. But it's the land of Breaking Bad and Billy the Kid, if that means anything to you. So, this is a subject I've been working on, outer space warfare, for close to 49 years now. And there was a time in my life where I had 86 different security clearances, but that all timed out 9 years ago when I retired. So I freely talk about what's in the open literature. I'm not going to talk about anything classified, but it might sound classified. I don't know, you know, since I don't have the clearances anymore. So at any rate, moving on, summary, I just talk a little bit about my experience. There's a past history of space warfare. There's actually been 10 different space wars since the 1970s. And so I'll go over some of those. And I've done a lot of classical studies on military theory. I have, you know, a personal library of 800 military books. And one of the big things I've been trying to do is it really doesn't matter if you're fighting ancient Greek warfare or futuristic space warfare. you might have different weapons and techniques, but it's still a human mind against a human mind. And that's important to keep that idea as part of this briefing, that really I'm not going to specifically talk about space weapons, though I have another briefing. It's 94 ways to attack satellites without creating debris. I can always present that too. So anyway, I'll look at the basic principles of fighting space wars. I'll talk and mathematically prove the space war that happened in 2014 over the Ukraine. What are some of the lessons learned? An update this year. Oh, by the way, spoiler alert, at least in the open literature, I heard that the British intelligence detected Putin giving the authorization to attack satellites in their next big counterattack. So I don't know if that's true or if we'll see a whole new world coming out, because the commercial satellites have been at irritation, if not being part of the kill chain, actually. And then it was asked of me to talk a little bit about a tool I put together that detects strange things happening in space. Like the Chinese seem to have a different orbital dynamics book and things they're trying to hide and stuff like that. So it detects automatically strange things. You know, suddenly a satellite is in a different orbit that it's been in for, you know, 5 years. Suddenly it's 10 times its radar cross section, you know, these sort of things. And it has tools that look to see if, okay, are you about to come under attack real soon? What are the attack indicators? And automated tools to try to determine what is the strategy the adversary is trying to implement against you. And also to match up characteristics of unknown objects to known objects to try to discern its possible mission. Now, you have to excuse me a little bit here. I only have an hour, and this is the shrunk down version of the briefing, but then it added on the SWOT and all that. So I'm going to kind of quickly go over some charts. And if you want more details, and I could send this charts to anyone who wants them, you know, they're unclassed. I could also present this to any of you guys and your associates or something, maybe the longer version, if you think it's interesting. And I tell you right now, it is. People are fascinated by this brief, and I've got 20 or 30 other subjects. Talk about fascination. These icons on the left are pictures of my personal military patch collection for a space warfare squadrons and so forth. This is the alien behind the green door. You know, they make fun of it. I can tell you stories about that, but I don't have the time. And there's a contest going on here. Astoundingly, I found a patch on eBay that appears to be celebrating a major security incident that could have caused the downfall of an allied government. I won't tell you which one it is, but see if you could figure it out. Oh, and on the right here, I've done a lot of 3D models of satellites, and this the latest in thing for multiple countries is what's called RPO, Rendezvous Proximity Operations. People at NASA call it maintenance satellites, repair satellites, inspection satellites. This is my version of it, of a satellite with manipulator arms with lasers and sensors, and I can't see it here, but a saw and all that, you know, to do kind of devilment that I could talk about later if I have time. So about me, it's by next year, it'll be 49 years experience in this. 27 of those years were deeply covert space weapons programs where I wasn't allowed to exist anymore. I couldn't go to conferences. We went through the garbage entrance to buildings. I have a letter from the Secretary of the Air Force, personally signed by him, saying police can't stop me. I don't have to go through security at the airport or anything like that. And we spent a considerable amount of time hiding from the rest of the U.S. government. And we had orders that if the military police ever showed up, we were supposed to hide from them. I'm not sure what that meant. But we had one gentleman who was coming out at 5 o'clock, the end of the day, go home. And there was a fire alarm went, and military police came, didn't like his fake ID like I had. Put him in jail for the night until the next morning. A special person showed up and says, release him and don't ask any questions. So it was that kind of thing that, you know, you have thermite charges on the safe. The president isn't briefed for plausible deniability, you know, that sort of stuff. Anyway, I published or lectured, probably it's actually up to 110 times now in the last few years across the world to allied nations and all that on these concepts, basic concepts of space warfare. Some people called me the father of space warfare doctrine. Other more imaginative souls said I'm possibly the first real life space mercenaries like Boba Fett, because I go around the world helping allied countries fight space wars. And then it was mentioned earlier that I have a space warfare discussion group. I got to update this. It's over 22,000 members now and 2,061, I think, general officers and so forth, and people from the White House and you know, congressional staffers, former secretaries of defense. I have the personal email of the Secretary of the Air Force, Secretary of Defense for France, and you know, it's a big group, let's say. And then I've been around the block, you know, National Security Council, the AQSC, it's called, Secretary of the Air Force at the Pentagon, who fund these kinds of programs, Joint Chiefs of Staffs, all over the place. Moving quickly. Oh, I love this quote from Churchill, and this is kind of what I'm emphasizing, that we're still talking about information warfare, psychological warfare, especially in space, since things are tens of thousands of kilometers away. It's very difficult to figure out what's happening. You know, your satellite died. Okay. Was it just natural? Was it a meteorite came in? You know, I'm at war with China in the Western Pacific. Oh, it must have been those guys. Well, maybe it's the Russians stirring the pot or the North Koreans. You know, the thing is, these anti-satellites, ASATs, space weapons, don't have big red stars painted on the side. It's not like you shoot down an aircraft or blow up a tank and you can go with the wreckage and look at serial numbers and things like that. I mean, it just stops working and you don't really know why. You don't know if it was intentional. It could have been human cause, but maybe not intentional. But if it's intentional, human cause, what is the strategy? Are they just trying to make a statement of, oh, we're mad at you, you know, stop whatever you're doing or else? Or are they trying to cut off command and control, imagery? You know, it's hard to figure. But I love this quote from Churchill. He says, well, you can take the most gallant sailor, the most intrepid airman, or the most audacious soldier, and you put them together in a room, and what do you get? The sum of their fears. And to me, all warfare is between adversary commanders' minds. And it is the sum of their fears, their education, their culture, their experience, their endurance, the politicians above them meddling and all that. And they send messages to each other through soldier sailors, airmen, guardians, whatever. They're trying to force their will, their intent, resolve, and things like that. And so they're just sending messages for him to give up or surrender or give, you know, negotiate or whatever. And ultimately, that's what it's about. And I've realized just over the last few months, you're not fighting the war, you're fighting the peace. The whole point of the war is geopolitical realignments afterwards. And so if you've got something like, look at these cool weapons I got, and I'm going to blow the hell out of everything in space, and suddenly you got all this debris, and you might have won the war, but you lost the peace. Your allies hate you now for, you know, ruining the space environment. Or they might have thought of you as some big bad space dude, and you hadn't have been war with China or Russia or something like that, and you lose. And they say, oh, I guess the U.S. isn't as great as we thought. Maybe we should start sidling up to China now or something. So these are like the implications. And there's things like the U.S. Space Force, I don't think has realized that yet. And you know, I've talked all the way down to lieutenant level to, you know, three-star generals. I'm on the general officer steering group for Air Force Research Lab. And these guys don't really know how to fight space wars. They just keep thinking tactically of, oh, we got to defend ourselves from this satellite coming close. Well, space is strategic by nature. It's global and it's very political. And it's also, you can get away with a lot up there without people knowing about it. And I'll show you that, the war in 2014, where it was a direct communication between Russia, the US, and Europe that people on the ground weren't really too familiar with. Anyway, so I've more or less gone over this, all warfare is between human minds. And then I want to, you know, even the ancient Greeks more than 2,000 years ago understood this, that it's not the objective of war to annihilate the people who caused it, but to cause them to mend their ways, essentially. So that's something important to, you know, to keep in mind. Plus, there's a lot of people say, oh, we don't want war in space. And it's like maybe the same people who don't want war in Antarctica. And it's like, you know, in some sense, that's a perfect place. There's no cities you're destroying. You're not killing civilians. You know, all the things you destroyed, the weapons get covered with snow afterwards. It's a perfect place. And it's almost the same with space, that there's no reason to attack the International Space Station. There's no big colonies in space and all that. You can show a lot of resolve and will and intent up there. And, you know, if you think of the United States, would it go to war without space? Would it be able to service targets without optical imagery to see which ones need to be attacked and what do they look like afterwards if they need to be reattacked? GPS for better accuracy, to be able to determine waypoints to get around anti-aircraft batteries, you know, communications and all that. It's conceivable that the war might happen in space before the war on the ground. And if you lose in space, you have no sense fighting on the ground. You're going to lose regardless. And another way of thinking about it too is that space, even though it's similar in some ways, it's very different. You know, similar to the ground is very different. Things like if you've got this space weapon, an anti-satellite, and you want to attack another satellite, there's only certain points in its orbit it can start maneuvering. It's not a continuous kind of thing. You know, it's just the orbital dynamics. So it ends up that if you want to do an attack against a set of targets in space, there's key choke points, which aren't necessarily fixed, but, you know, it's like a low Earth orbit kind of thing. It's a choke point. It's a certain altitude, inclination, and so forth. There's these choke points that you'd have to build up these anti-satellites first in order to attack a group of an adversary satellites. And it takes days and weeks to maneuver to these key choke points. Now, if you had good space surveillance, good intel on the ground maybe and all that, you can determine that, oh, it looks like they're building up to attack. And you can maybe frustrate that attack physically or go to the United Nations and say, well, any clever adversary is going to attack the U.S. in space first to take out its eyes and ears before they attack on the ground. It looks like they're about to attack us in space, which means they want to attack us on the ground, you know. And so you might, again, space war might prevent wars. Now, there's all kinds of ways to, in the United States, so you call it skin the cat. Classically, the Air Force, Space Force talked about three different ways of attacking satellites. And these are MIL standard 2525D icons that have been extended because they hardly hit any for space. But we have, let's say, a typical target here. And the latest in thing are rendezvous and proximity operations, RPO satellites, inspector satellites, whatever you want to call them. Everyone on the block has to have one. And the U.S. will proudly talk about the six they have up there in orbit. They complain about the Russian one getting too close to their National Reconnaissance Office satellites. That China has them that are getting close and all that. That's all in the open. I've been on five different programs over my lifetime on these kinds of inspection satellites. But in some sense, you know, versions of them have manipulator arms like you see here. In some sense, that's a perfect space weapon. It's like taking a satellite, putting it in a wheelbarrow, wheeling it into the garage, and then going at it. You know, let's drill a hole, let's cut this wire, let's bend this, let's saw that, let's grab it and pull it out of orbit, you know, And while we're on that subject, there was something in the press a few months ago. China has what's called Dadao. It's their navigation satellite, like GPS. And they said, oh, this poor satellite, we launched it and it failed immediately. And it's been drifting around the geosynchronous belt. And so we're going to grab a hold of it and pull it out so it doesn't hit anybody. Of course, it's been drifting for years. They didn't care before that. And so they said, well, we grabbed it and you know, one of these manipulative things with the arms and pulled it out of orbit, which, of course, you can do to an adversary satellite, too, I guess, pulled out of orbit to graveyard orbit. And I look at that and says, well, you know, I'm sort of a rocket scientist, and graveyard orbit is 300 kilometers plus or minus geosynchronous above or below. And they pulled it to 3,000 kilometers. And it's like, well, you know, fuel is everything in space. You're not going to use up extra fuel if you don't want to, unless you're trying to hide something. And it's funny that they did this 2 days after the U.S. launched two more of its inspector satellites. So it sounds, you know, suspicious. And my suspicious sense, or maybe I just sort of know where the skeletons are buried, says, you know, what this really was, the Chinese faked the death of this Badao satellite. It really was an inspector satellite. Who knows if it had a little gun on it or something. And they've been drifting around, faking like it's dead, but inspecting things or maybe doing mean things, who knows? And they suddenly realized they had to get the evidence out of the way. And why do I readily believe that? I was on a program 35 years ago to do that very same thing. None of this is new. Anyway, getting back to ways to take out a satellite. You can take out the satellite, you can take out the ground network, you can take out the links between them. Space, I guess, is 100% information. It generates information, imagery, signals intelligence, navigational PNT information. It transmits it. So you're really almost talking about info wars. And you're not necessarily attacking a satellite, you're attacking the information it's generating or transmitting. So you could have $1 trillion worth of space gear up there, which I think we almost do now, but it's totally worthless if you seal it off from the ground, jamming, cyber, destroy the ground terminals, whatever. You can't get the information, you can't transmit it, you can't command the satellite to look a different place or go into self-defense mode. You know, there's a lot of ways to deny the information being generated from satellites, not necessarily blow the hell out of them. So history of space war, how much time? Okay, I have to go faster. Yeah, it goes back to Roman times, the Lucians' true history. They had Roman legions attacking the moon. And I guess they had giant spiders they had to deal with or something like that. And then a year after Sputnik was launched, we have a famous artist, Frank Tinsley, has this space fighter blowing up a satellite. And then, you know, they have Bold Orion and Program 437M, the nuclear anti-satellites. I have a piece of the computer from Program 437M from Johnston Island. And if you get this briefing, you can click on here and it'll go to the websites. You know, this is all on class. The Russians actually had an anti-aircraft cannon on their Almaz. You can see that. You know, here's a picture from the web. They freely admit that now. Now, I'm not sure how exactly that works. I mean, every force has an equal and opposite reaction, and so the thing would recoil if you shot the spacecraft, and you'd probably like screw up your orbit a bit, and then okay, the shell goes and hits this satellite coming at you or something. Well, all you've done is make a big piece into a lot of little pieces like a shotgun that are still coming at you. So again, I don't know how that works. But at any rate, I was on the F-15 anti-satellite program at the Pentagon at the time. The guy in charge told me it was a negotiating chip with the Russians, I guess with their kinetic ASAT. Here's some concepts the Russians have of a space laser that almost looks like it's on the moon. Here's this kind of the Frank Tinsley concept. And then I want to emphasize again, there's many ways to do space warfare. And one is during Desert Storm, we took out some of the heavy earth terminals there. So the Iraqis couldn't, we were worried about them detecting the left hook. Matter of fact, I'm friends with the Navy captain who was in charge of Schwarzkopf intel staff. And he said Schwarzkopf purposely put the French forces on the leftmost, most vulnerable part of the left hook so that they would inspire them to turn off their spot imagery satellite so Iraq couldn't see the left hook, you know. And so that's kind of a space warfare, economic, diplomatic warfare, I don't know. Okay, previous space attacks. I was at the FCC, Laurel, Maryland, Federal Communications Commission, Laurel, Maryland satellite monitoring station in the 80s. And they told me in the 60s, they detected a Russian trawler jamming one of our commsats. Well, it's called commsat, unimaginatively. Who knows what that was about? CSAT, early in the night, it was a NASA satellite to measure sea height, wave height. And the company I was working at the time in Washington, D.C., we hired a NASA employee. And he told me that when NASA launched this satellite, they said, oh, my gosh, we can detect submarines at operating depth because it just sort of wiggled the waves a little bit different. And it was just this big arrow pointing to where the submarine was. And they said, you know, it negated one third of the U.S. nuclear triad. And again, you could actually see that online. They talk about that. And according to this NASA guy, says, well, they purposely turned it off. Now, years later, I'm on programs where we're imaging it as best we can. And here's one of those images. And the satellite's all bent out of shape, like somebody attacked it. Again, I don't know the details, but whatever. 1980s, for about 6-8 months, both Russia and the United States couldn't get any satellites in orbit. Their boosters just kept blowing up and falling into the ocean and all that. And it almost statistically didn't seem right. It's almost as if we were attacking each other's boosters. I mean, I've heard stories that some of the NASA things being launched from Florida, somebody with a high-powered rifle out in the ocean could take it out because those boosters are very thin-skinned and so forth. Anyway, I already mentioned the Desert Storm. There was an incident in the 2010s I can't talk about in detail, but the rumor has it it was started by a drunken Russian colonel. Let's see. Somebody just told me last year that NOAA satellites in the Southeast Pacific were cyber attacked by the Chinese. You know, again, I don't know why, you know, what the situations are. And then I will talk and actually mathematically prove the attack on the Russian GLONASS satellites in 2014. And then if any of you guys wonder why there's a U.S. Space Force and why even Japan is just starting an Air and Space Force this week, French now have the Air and Space Force. There's a Space Command in the U.K. And it's like, well, let's see now. Congress, U.S. Congress established this Space Force, and the Republicans and the Democrats couldn't agree on anything, but they could readily agree on the Space Force. And it's like, well, something must have happened. Well, I was in France for a week last year, invited out by the French Air and Space Force in Lyon. And two French lieutenant colonels told me why there's a Space Force. And this is unclassified briefing. I don't have any clearances. They say an American cyber satellite, space-based infrared at geosynchronous, it's a missile warning satellite. One of these Chinese manipulator satellite came up to it with the manipulator arms and started tearing it apart. Now it's like, okay, I guess that was kind of a space incident, space war. It's why we need a space force. Now, I don't know. I doubt the Chinese would do that for the fun of it. There must've been something the US did beforehand, and US probably did something afterwards, but at least three people have verified that. And there's kind of funny stories to that too, because a few months ago, a major news personality in the United States was interviewing a US Space Force general officer. He says, General, sir, what if one of these Chinese manipulator satellites came up to one of your cyber satellites and started attacking it? What would you do? And they were talking theoretically, but obviously the press knows about it. Congress knows about it. Governments around the world know about it. And we're fat, dumb, and happy sitting here on the street not knowing about it, you know, kind of thing. And that's maybe the beauty of space, you can get away with a lot. So moving on, I just want to emphasize, and I'm sorry I have to go a little quicker here. Space is global. Nothing's tactical in space. And because of the political, now, of course, you can get away with a lot. I've realized that countries are just like children. They'll do anything they want if they get away with it from their parents. And if the countries can keep these things hidden, that's fine. And that's not unusual for space. I heard like there was an incident between a Russian and an American submarine in the Sea of Japan several months ago. It was in the press, but there was no news reporter with a camera and all that. And so you hear nothing more. You go to CIA headquarters and you have all these stars on the wall of agents that have died in the line of duty. I don't know if any of those caused any war, but we don't know anything about it. So countries love to keep things secret. That's all I'm saying. And space is sort of like a safety valve for that kinds of things. And there's, you know, a lot been happening because of it. Now, you keep things hidden, not only hidden from other countries, it's just between you and the threat country. It's hidden from the rest of your government. I mean, I've heard stories, first of all, the Chinese anti-satellite test, I forget, it was a 2007 or something, a few years back. The indications were they purposely showed they were setting up for the test so the U.S. can see that they were able to do it as a kind of deterrence or source of pride or something like that. I even know some guys who went up and I think it was the Himalayas to, with sensors to, you know, watch it. But then I also heard that the main Chinese government didn't know they were going to do it, you know, because of political implications. So anyway, I mean, if the U.S. Space Force starts a war in space, you think they'd tell the Navy? No. Oh, and by the way, just as an aside, there's a lot of astronomers, amateur astronomers around the world who pull their money and buy these automated telescopes. They're like $30,000, $40,000 each, and they put them in some remote area, and then every night they go online and, you know, watch the stars or something like that. It seems to me any country on Earth can buy a set of these telescopes and plant them on the rooftops of their embassies around the world. You know, they have good weather without clouds and so forth, and track all this stuff happening in space, because situational awareness is everything. And I would think a country like Israel or whatever could spend a few million dollars on that. And the political diplomatic value of knowing that the U.S. and China are at war with each other in space, I think is priceless, you know. Okay, so I already mentioned the different means of attacking space systems. You know, there's diplomatic, economic, all kinds of cyber. I have a whole briefing on 94 ways to attack satellites without creating debris. Most of those are cyber. There's the classic directed energy laser. Oh, by the way, you guys can see me, right? This is a 7-watt blue laser I bought online. It would set your furniture on fire across the room in a fraction of a second. It wouldn't take much to put this on a satellite, you know, space qualified, better, maybe 100 watts or something like that. And if you get close enough to a satellite, you could probably do all kinds of damage. And it could be on a commercial satellite, a civil satellite that, you know, you're kind of hiding what it really is. Oh, this is a proposal from a few years back, high-powered microwave sticky bomb that they were developing for sticking on other things on Earth. But they said, well, we could stick to a satellite too. This is showing you pictures of a blinding from a ground-based laser. When I was in France, they proudly told me about their mobile laser blinder system that would blind. And then they say, oh, and we could turn up the power and do some damage too. You know, so there's a lot out there. I mean, I haven't checked. There used to be a website, jammers.com, where you can buy satellite jammers. And Russia has all sorts of satellite jammers. I'm surprised they haven't jammed. Well, I guess they've been jamming GPS, but they haven't, you know, been jamming other satellite systems. But I think that might be changing. Anyway, so we got the directed energy. Physical attacks, you know, attacking the ground systems, maybe even putting in Trojan code in some satellite chips that years later go on a satellite and suddenly you've got a cyber control of it or something like that. Okay, so how do you win a space war? And I've got a lot of doctrine I don't have time to show you, but the prime characteristics is situational awareness is everything. Now it's true on the ground too, but even more true in space. You know, it's tens of thousands of kilometers away. You really can't see what's coming off. You're really not sure who's even attacking you. My simulations have shown a space war is over with in 24 to 48 hours. And I've also heard the National Command authorities aren't going to counterattack until they know who attacked them in space. Well, it takes days and weeks to kind of assume who attacked you, estimate, and by then the war is over with. So maybe space is kind of unstable, like nuclear weapons. Whoever attacks first wins. I don't know. The other thing is pre-conflict positioning. It takes days and weeks to maneuver satellites around. So you might sit there and say, oh, look at these cool weapon systems. And I know I've been on 15 different weapon system programs. There's been space weapons for 50 or 60 years. They are old when I signed up, you know, 45 years ago. There's all these things around there, and you always have to worry about your own being fooled by your own intelligence, your own pride, ego, whatever. The thinking, oh, look at all these great things we have. Well, we designed them all for war over the Western Pacific, but it takes weeks to maneuver them to a war in Europe. You know, and your NATO allies might say, oh, we got all these great space things. We can, you know, help you with the war in the Pacific. Well, they won't get there in time. So essentially, you got to fight with what you got there in the position. And the thing is, do I evenly space between Eastern and Western hemispheres? You know, who are going to go to war with the next 10 years? How do you figure that out? Should I put my space-based lasers over Europe and then my kinetic kill vehicles over the Western Pacific? You know, and since we're talking about information war for space, you're really denying the information, not necessarily the satellite. You might say, well, gee, autocratic regimes probably depend more on command and control, because if forces on the ground don't get commands from their senior leadership, they're going to freeze because they don't want to get shot. So maybe it's better to have cyber warfare kinds of systems over Western Pacific, China, or whatever. But maybe a different flavor if you're going to go against a different kind of psychology of a military mind. I don't know. You know, I've been proposing we need a space warfare think tank to start thinking these things through before we spend hundreds of billions of dollars on space weapons. And I know they've been designing them for years. At any rate, maneuverability is everything. And then command decisiveness. You might have the best things up there, but if you sit there and twiddle your thumbs for days and weeks, it's over with. So it's like any war on the ground too. Anyway, here's indications of space attack. No time to show you. Okay, I'm particularly interested in, you know, detecting attacks in space, detecting if we're about to be attacked, which implies we might be attacked on the ground. Space escalation. Can you have a war in space without escalating to the ground and vice versa? And I've already mentioned where space provides a forum where maybe countries can blow off steam among each other. And actually, this is what happened in 2014. Give me a few minutes. Let's see how much time I got here. And then the, you know, so you, actually in 2014, the space and ground attacks were linked. And spoiler alert again, the US lost that war, because of a lack of understanding of combined arms. And then the thing is, how do you define winning a space war? I mean, traditionally for terrestrial conflicts, you have these, you know, surrender criteria. You gain territory, adversary territory, destroys war-making capabilities, you seize the capital, depose the government. Okay, yeah, that all makes sense. Well, is there territory in space? There's no capital. We're really trying to influence the ground. How do you decide you won the space war? And both sides can say, oh, we won. And one side says, I took out all your communication satellites. And the other guy, no, I took out all your imagery satellites. What's more important? What if you have 10 targets and only 5 anti-satellite weapon systems? Which kind should you go against? That's a hard one because, deny the adversary imagery of the battlefield. He can't see these tanks coming around behind him. You have to kind of model the human mind of maybe he's some old fogey who doesn't believe in the space data anyway. The Army is used to doing simulations of, well, if I take out this bridge over this river, I delay his forces 6 hours and the war ends 2 days earlier. You know, they can do these kind of calculations. So if I take out this communication satellite or his GPS, Badao, GLONASS, whatever, what's the impact? You know, should I spend $100 million on this weapon system taking out the GPS, or should I take that $100 million and train and equip an army division? You know, what's more effective on the ultimate battlefield, which is not space, it's the ground. You know, space is there to support the ground. There's no colonies in space. So I've got a lot of ideas on that. That'd be another briefing. Any rate, and then I already mentioned this, space wars might be better than fighting terrestrial wars. But I've also mentioned there might be a hair trigger, instability. You know, I mentioned this attack in 2017 on the American SBIRS satellite that the French claimed, you know, I don't know one way or the other. Now, to me, that's insane. It's like, this is a missile warning satellite. It's going to detect launches of missiles, how many missiles are coming at you, which way are they coming, and so forth. If an adversary wanted to start a nuclear war, the first thing he would do is take out your eyes in space so you can't see where the missiles are coming and the nuclear detonations and what cities to take out, whatever. So that's kind of a hair trigger there that you shouldn't get close to any adversary's missile warning satellite because he might get an itchy trigger finger thinking you're starting a nuclear war. So those should really be sacrosanct. So you got to be an idiot, you know, to go against these things. So I don't know what the politics was all about. Okay, and I had some possible space war termination criteria. You know, the balance of power in space is sufficient to deter the red side for the next 10 years until he launches a new one. His ability to fight in space, you know, is severely restricted. He can't image the battlefield with less than 1 meter resolution. You took out his high resolution imagery satellites. These are just all theoretical. His amount of delta V maneuvering fuel has been reduced by 50%. You know, it's almost made him 50% less effective. All his anti-satellite capabilities you've been able to detect, you don't know what's secretly hidden, and you know, some are. You only think he's got a 10% left. 90% of his suspicious looking assets have been visited by an inspector satellites to verify. I mean, these all these things that maybe be the criteria for the war. Now, you might want to look at Joint Chiefs of Staff PUB 5-0. It's genius. It's how do you fight wars on the ground? And they say, well, before you even start any sort of courses of action, deployment of forces and things like that, list the surrender criteria and then work off from there. You know, okay, we'll put forces here because the surrender criteria would be capturing the adversary capital or something like that. Well, you got to do the same thing for space. Why are you attacking this particular satellite? So why are you attacking it? When should you attack it? And what results do you want? And do you understand secondary results? And the Russian attack on, let's say, the VSAT system in 2014 had very much secondary results. So you got to, you know, understand all that. And I don't think anyone's thinking this through. Anyway, how to win? Situational awareness, positioning, decisive political will. You can have the best systems on the planet, but if you really don't know how to use them, if you don't really have good doctrine, if you don't have a good commander, and there's so many instances in history where superior forces were beaten by inferior forces. And, you know, you might have a Maginot Line that is the highest tech thing in the world, but you were fighting the previous war and you lose. And space is even more confusing because we don't have enough experience of that. How to lose? Uncertainty and confusion. You self-deter. Oh, I don't want to start a space war. Oh, it's too late. You just lost. You're in the wrong position. You never thought you'd have a war in Europe this year. You know, the future political impacts. Oh, you won the war, lost the peace. You lost. And maybe the space war is fought on the ground. You take out all those terminals or whatever, and maybe even do cyber attacks, and you fake the data coming down from the satellites to the point where the adversary commanders don't trust whatever's coming out of it. I mean, there's all sorts of mind games you can play. Okay, what happened in Ukraine? Going over the timeline. And again, this is all in the open press. I don't know anything about this specifically, but I list the different attacks coming from the blue side and the red side. So 20 February 2014, how much time do I got? I'm rolling here. The conflict starts in Europe. It was kind of before that, but 88 people were killed. In March, the Ukrainians attempted to decay the orbit of a Russian communication satellite being used in over Ukraine. Now, that's kind of crazy. You can't decay an orbit from you if this was a geosynchronous satellite. But they tried to jam it and corrupt it and, you know, cyber attack, whatever. And then the big one that I'm going to talk about, and I'm going to mathematically prove, 2nd of April, the entire Russian GLONASS, their GPS, PNT, positioning, navigation, timing system, had a system-wide failure. All 24 satellites didn't work for 13 hours. I'll show you the analysis. Now, I could kind of fantasize here or something like, well, I'm not sure how much they used GLONASS, at least then. You know, they weren't putting precision weapons on targets and all that. And Ukraine used to be Russia. It's like they know where all the roads are and stuff like that. I don't think they're particularly getting lost. So it wasn't necessarily militarily effective to attack GLONASS. It was a political message. And it seems to me the message wasn't received right. Now, messaging, you know, it's like nuking Hiroshima. And the Japanese didn't get the message immediately, so they took out Nagasaki because they thought the Americans only had one nuke weapon and all that. So the U.S. attacked again 2 weeks later just to, you know, give the message. I'll show later they just pissed off the Russians. And then there's a bunch of other things that I can't mathematically prove, but a bunch of Russian satellites started failing, you know, statistically improbable. And then I'm sort of listing these different kinds of attacks, and not just like blowing up satellites, but Russia in April made what I call a diplomatic economic attack. At the time, they were launching American astronauts to the International Space Station, and the head of Roscosmos said, well, you can use a trampoline now to get up there. So, you know, that's a threat, but that's space warfare. Okay, my personal favorite, in May, Russia launched a Proton vehicle carrying a heavy telecommunications satellite that would have covered eastern Ukraine and never reached orbit. It fell on a Chinese village while Putin was in China selling Russian space capabilities. Now, that's just very circumstantial. I can't prove that somehow somebody caused that thing to crash. That's the thing, you know, it's like the CIA. You never know what's the truth. But anyway, there's a whole bunch of other failed things. We are talking about navigation satellite attacks going against GLONASS. And suddenly the European Galileo, their GPS had issues, you know, and I don't know, again, if that was a warning message. But so this is my interpretation of what happened. The U.S. started attacking Russian GLONASS satellites, and I'll mathematically prove that. And oh, by the way, I was at the Pentagon at the time, job interviewing, and in an unclassified environment, I didn't have security clearance and all that. They told me they were thinking of attacking Russian satellites. And 4 days later, GLONASS starts blinking out. what that's worth. So I can see these U.S. Space Force people gleefully having fun attacking these satellites, thinking they're superior. Russia got pissed off, and they took the war down to the ground, and they attacked the American banking system on 28 August. Again, it was in the press. Tens of millions of stock accounts, bank accounts were downloaded from five major banks in Manhattan and in New York City. And at the time, the bank people say, well, it looks like it's coming from Russian servers. And then suddenly there was silence and you never heard anything more about it. But suddenly Obama stopped talking bad about the Russians over Ukraine. And a week later, everybody was at the negotiating table over the Ukrainian issue at that time. So I interpreted it to mean that U.S. is doing very well in space. The Russians took the war down to the ground, extorted the Americans and said, hey, if you don't stop what you're doing, we're going to release all these tens of millions of bank accounts to hackers or whatever. Obama caved and suddenly they're at the negotiating table. So the U.S. lost the war. My interpretation. Okay, let's go over the specifics of this GLONASS attack. And I have time. This is a map of the English Channel. This is Britain. This is a guy, this red dot is a guy with the Russian GLONASS satellite receiver. And this is where he's physically located, but the receiver is saying he's out in the middle of the English Channel. In other words, the signal's corrupted somehow. I don't know. There was probably a cyber attack against the atomic clock on GLONASS satellites. I don't really know the specifics. But, you know, this was published. And what else was published? The Russians published the date and time here of their GLONASS satellites and when they started blinking out. And I look at that and I say, well, you know, I'm a rocket scientist. I have my orbital dynamic software. I'm going to propagate these satellites and see where on Earth they were every time they blinked out. Well, lo and behold, they were over Alice Springs, Australia. Every time a Russian GLONASS satellite came over it, just through the orbital dynamics, it would blink out. And it would start at exactly 6:30 a.m. in the morning. And, you know, I've kind of been to these sites and they come in at 6 and get their coffee. And 6:15, they start simulating attack. And 6:30, they started the attack. And if there are several Russian GLONASS satellites in view of this Alice Springs, they would be attacked in numerical order. GLONASS 1, 2, 3, and 4. It was obviously intentional. Now, let me stop sharing this. And I'm going to share again my other screen. And I'll show you the actual orbital dynamics. And let's see. You should be able to see my screen right at the moment of the orbital dynamics.
Yes, we see it.
Good. Now, this is, you know, the actual orbits of the LUSH GLONASS systems. The white lines are when those actual satellites are within view of Alice Springs. Now, I say Alice Springs, I'm really talking about a location called Pine Gap. And look it up on the internet. The Australians have made three movies on it. It's a so-called secret NSA listening site. It's been there since the 1960s. And it just mathematically, by the orbital dynamics, it's obvious to me that there was some sort of space weapon there that started taking out these Russian GLONASS satellites. Now, this is just looking at it zoomed in. And you can look at exactly date and time that the Russians reported that they had been taken out. It started exactly at sunrise, I guess, more or less sunrise. And this is looking up azimuth elevation plot and, you know, which way the antenna of the space cyber weapon would have been pointed when they were coming over. These are the times of opportunity when they would be coming over. So to me, that was obvious. Now let's go back to my briefing here somewhere there. So I've shown you these charts. Oh, and this is a Google Map picture of Pine Gap, the super secret, you know, NSA listening point in Central Australia. And here's, you know, all this satellite antennas. And just for fun's sake, I show you a picture of one of the movies the Aussies made about Pine Gap, because it's a big mystery to them. And this is where an aliens attacked and attacked the Pine Gap, and you see the crashed radomes and all that. It's just sort of a fun picture. Anyway, the U.S. will proudly talk about their counter-communication system. You can see that online. Electronic warfare, cyber warfare for against satellites. Here's a picture of them in Colorado Springs, though they are based in Alamogordo, New Mexico, south of the part of the state that I live in. Who knows if these guys were deployed there at the time? I didn't really look into it. So conclusions. Failures of the seven Russian systems over 4 months is statistically very unusual. The GLONASS failure starting exactly at 6:30 a.m. local time, and in numerical order, it is too much to believe that it was natural or anything like that. I can mathematically prove it through the orbital dynamics. Maybe the counter communication system was used, maybe something else. The other attacks are circumstantial. They always are. You're never really sure. Maybe the attacks on the Galileo system from Europe was a warning. Attack on the American banking system is what stopped the space war and the Ukrainian conflict. I interpret that as a loss. So lessons learned. Okay, these space weapons can be deployed anywhere. You know, that's kind of the beauty of space. It's global. You don't have to have them in theater. You can have them on a deck of a ship in the South Atlantic. I mean, down the road here on base, there's a group I briefed inside the wire of the nuclear storage facility that used to be there that go out with these satellite antennas. They weld them to the decks of Navy ships and go observe things like their Chinese ASAT tests and stuff like that. You could have had one of these jammers on there in the South Atlantic. You could have had them on the rooftops of embassies around the world. You could have made it so it wasn't easy for some guy in the street like me using unclassified data, readily available orbital dynamics software to come to the conclusions that, yeah, this was intentional. Now, the other side of the coin is the whole point of the attack wasn't necessarily militarily, but was diplomatic. And so you can't make the attack too obscure. Maybe that's why they had to attack 2 days later again. It can't be too obscure to the recipient so they don't get the message. there's a balance going on there. So I think one of the lessons for space war is space is always strategic and political, and it can really be linked to what might happen on the ground. You got to think of combined arms principles. And for years, I've been telling these space dudes, when you're developing these space weapons programs, you really ought to have the State Department in early on these, because they're going to be at the National Security Council saying, nope, you can't do that. And if you have them early on in the program, they might say, well, tweak it slightly this way, it'll be more acceptable to us and all. And these guys always say, nah, we don't want those State Department people. We don't trust them. And, you know, I have the 22,000 members in my space warfare discussion group, and one of them is former Assistant Secretary of State in the United States. And he says, yeah, they're right. The State Department loves any sort of space treaty, no matter how damaging it is to U.S. interests. So it's the typical, one part of the government against another part of the government. It's true, I guess, of all governments. At any rate, what's happening lately? So I mentioned earlier, Viasat is a European, I think British-based satellite communication system that essentially was cyber attacked by the Russians, but not the satellite, the ground modems that received the satellite information. And surprisingly, it affected tens of thousands of modems. And surprisingly, it physically destroyed, I think, half of them or something like that. And I don't know how a cyber attack physically destroys something. But one of the consequences was 5,000 windmills in Europe stopped working that were controlled by this. This is the secondary effects and things like that. And then there's a lot of things. I'm running out of time here that we can go over with, Russia doing kind of diplomatic economic attacks. They say, now we refuse to launch the OneWeb satellite system because of the sanctions, and that the satellite was already on the rocket in, I don't know, Kazakhstan or something like that. And they said, okay, we're not going to launch it. And now we own your satellite too. You know, so those are space warfare kinds of things. Now, for all I know, there's all kinds of funny businesses going on with these satellite inspectors up there. You know, I'm sure China's satellite inspector is coming close to American and Russian ones to see what they're doing with the war. They can observe which way the optics are pointed just to see what particular target they're interested in. And I don't know if there's been direct military actions, because they can, you know, I don't have security clearances. They can cover that up and all that. I think they probably will be in the next few weeks to the month, is kind of what I've heard. So, and then, you know, there's been jamming of GPS signals. That's kind of a standard thing to do nowadays. Okay. Well, I got to spend another 5-10 minutes. My space warfare analysis tools. Essentially, I put together grand strategies, operational strategy tactics, link them to terrestrial courses of action. I have a whole space war game that's automatically generated with this tool. It looks at space battle management kinds of things. And again, space isn't there for its own right. It's there for the ground. So you have to use the same terminology, the same principles and all that. So the terrestrial commanders understand what you're talking about, and you can understand their needs better and all that. So I'm taking classical terrestrial military principles and relating them to futuristic or maybe nowadays space warfare things. I mean, I've taken Sun Tzu's Art of War, and I'm only halfway through, but I've started taking his principles and generalizing them to space. And I have over 700 space courses of action based on them. And they're all applicable one way or the other, because again, we're talking about human minds. And then I can't go over all of this, but you know, the classic OODA loop, they call it, observe, orient, decide, and act. And you know, I have things like space choke point maps, state change things I talk about that are funny things. They all sort of feed into this OODA loop. And then one of the main things I have is I look at all these kind of characteristics of satellites. And I have databases, you know, going back to 1957, quite frankly. I download them every 2 weeks. You know, it's open to the public. And what I do is I have history of characteristics, not only orbital elements, but, you know, radar cross-section, optical cross-section, spin rate, and all this stuff. And so what happens is you have a history of these satellites. And let's say some country says, this is a meteorologic, you know, weather satellite. And so it's within this 26-dimensional space of characteristics. And it's kind of wiggling around in that space, you know, as time goes on and measurement errors and all that. And then suddenly, you know, it's been in this kind of looking just like another weather satellite. It's about the same size and it's about in the same orbital parameters and all that. And suddenly now it's 10 times the size. What does that mean? Did something come out of it? It's suddenly in a different orbit. So this software, all it does is looks at everything in space. And by everything, I mean, you know, all 40,000 plus objects, because I know they're hiding objects that are supposedly dead but aren't. You can just see by the orbital elements. And it looks at those and determines of, okay, over the last 24 hours, what objects have changed the most, so that you can task your better intel assets to take a look at those. And it also adds up, well, what country had the most changes over the last 24 hours? Suddenly Russia has 10 times the changes you normally see. Does that mean they're building up for space war? And then there's other tools in there that this is looking at all the characteristics of altitude, inclination, eccentricity, and all that. And you can see for like altitude, this particular object, you know, is tooling along for years like this, and suddenly its altitude's different and maneuvered or something like that. And the thing is if it just to maneuver means it actually changed attitude too. So it has a different radar cross-section, it has different orbital elements, maybe a different mass and so forth. And so all these little things changes add up to one big change, and the thing pops up that, oh, yeah, something suspicious happened there. And so that's kind of what I'm showing here. Okay, suspicious things. If you look, this is Badao, their Chinese navigation satellites. And this is all of the GPS American satellites. And even though Badao is in a different orbit, it gets within 2,500 kilometers of every single GPS satellite up there within 30 days. And 2,500 kilometers isn't much in space, doesn't take much fuel. And who knows if they're dropping off space mines as they're going along. You know, this is the kind of thing this tool detects, strange behavior. Also, it detects adversary intent. If it looks at all these strange behaviors and you put in all these things of, oh, suddenly I see more unknown objects and suddenly this and all this, and you put that all together, it tries to determine what are the strategies being implemented against you at that time based on that evidence, and it's automated. Another thing is, I've seen, you know, Air Force research labs here. They love the technology beyond usefulness many times. And they have things like, oh, look at this three-dimensional display we have. And I have a data glove and I touch the satellite and this and that, you know, and I'm thinking, well, here's these 40,000 objects zooming all over the place. That's not telling you anything. You can't see an attack coming up in there. So I've developed new ways of looking at things, putting together space situational maps that even an army general can understand. Sorry, I'm not insulting anyone here. And so the two most important things to my mind are altitude versus inclination. And so this is altitude versus inclination plot of all the objects up there. And you can see there's kind of a red zone and a blue zone and, you know, bad guys, good guys, neutral. And you can see how when objects start coming close to you, is readily apparent in this. That's where you see the flashing, that something changed with the state change. You can see, like, what are these Chinese red boosters doing in my blue zone? You know, so it's kind of an obvious thing to see if you're coming under attack. And if you zoom down, you see all these MIL standard icons. You can see satellites starting to maneuver and things like that. And I know I'm running out of time here. There's another way, and okay, yeah, it's complicated, but it's showing you the attack vectors, little puffs of smoke, so to speak, where they're starting to maneuver, where they're starting to attack, and it's sort of a situation map. And all these round things are the space surveillance sensors. You're trying to avoid those sensor cones from the red side, but you want to go over your own so that you can update accuracy and stuff like that. And then looking at battle planning, there's different zones. And I took air defense planning, and it maps perfectly to space. And so you have, how close is something getting to you and how worried should you be? And so you've got like a blue, green, yellow, and red zones, depending on, you know, are you 10 kilometers away, 1 kilometer, you know, 20 minutes and so forth. And then there's space defense identification zones combined. I forget the engagement zones and so forth. And these are the different defense condition, DEFCON levels that you go in. So it's just this sort of theoretical where you're talking at this level, you're a strategic, you're at an operational level of war and tactical level of war. So it's just, there's a lot of like doctrinal things you're trying to figure out. And it's kind of different. This is a plot of an attack on a space asset. And it's showing you how close they're getting. And what it's showing you is, and these are the different keep out zones or space defense identification zones. And it shows that in some sense, you have a double tap. If you're trying to match the orbit of another satellite, you come by it really close and then go away and then come back. So there's things you kind of worry, maybe got a laser that you can zap things. So in summary, I'm kind of finished. These are all the various documents. I've got like, you know, Porcupine defense for satellites, things like that. If you get this briefing, you can click on those. And I'm available to brief these to you and your associates, you know, via Zoom or in person. And then I mentioned that I have this space warfare discussion group. It's over 22,000 members. You're welcome to send me an invite on LinkedIn. And you know, I've got like over 2,000 general officers and admirals and, you know, secretaries of defenses and secretary of the Air Force and the secretary of defense of France and, you know, congressmen and astronauts and all kinds of people on there. So they're largely quiet. Okay, question time.
Wow, Paul, that was really interesting. Thanks. And yes,
and that's the short version. I can give you a longer version if you want.
Yeah. but I think you were just on time, which is good. But we are opening this to Q&A. If you guys want, you can unmute yourself and ask questions or write in the chat if you prefer, whatever is.
Yeah, if you write in the chat, I can't see it too easy. I don't know. Maybe you could, I guess I can now. I can't chat and talk at the same time. Let's see.
I will, if there's anything
you can relay it. Yeah.
I can start with a question.
And also, like, I have this question about SWAT. I don't even know who it's from. You know, in some sense, it's probably, we ask questions here, but if you really want me to answer and send you briefings, send me an email. You know, and then I know who you are and where you're coming from and stuff like that. So go for it.
Yeah. Well, my question was about SWAT as well. And then maybe about the patches, which you didn't talk about, and they're really cool. So with the SWAT, what is the input to this system? Because you have like data about many, many satellites and their orbit and inclination, et cetera. Where do you get all that information from?
Spacetrack.com is, see, legally the US is obligated to provide the United Nations satellite catalog. You know, they've been doing it, I don't know, 30, 40 years now. And so they publish orbital elements of space objects. And if nothing else, for more for traffic control and things like that. So you can sign up to that site. I every 2 weeks download the whole entire space catalog. Now, I haven't been doing any of this detecting strange things happening in space, because when I used to do it, it seemed like no one cared. The Space Force didn't care. I don't know why. I could show that things were coming under attack. Strange things like I mentioned China has a different orbital dynamics book. They would raise things up to a graveyard orbit, yet SWAT can show that the orbital elements were getting better with time instead of worse. You know, solar pressure, different gradients of the gravity on the Earth should make them start going spinning out and doing crazy things. They obviously were hiding them. So after I retired, I haven't been running this, but I readily could start it again. And I've been downloading the data just in case somebody gets interested. Now, just as an aside, I can detect satellites dying before they're publicly announced that they're dying. You know, they start getting squirrely and stuff like that. Now, it seems to me, if a $200 million commercial satellite's about to die, you could play the stock market. It must affect the stocks. And this is publicly available information. You know, you're not doing anything illegal. So besides the military, there's maybe a commercial end to that. Did I answer the question? I forgot.
Yeah, I think you did at the beginning. But how do you know when a satellite is dying, kind of?
Well, its orbital characteristics get funny. Its radar. See, most of the satellites now, there's not too many spinners. You know, those more like 1960s satellites.
So they're stabilized.
They're pointed to Earth, and they really got to be pointed good for those antennas. And if they stop, and so they have a certain radar cross-section and optical cross-section. And, you know, there's a certain amount of brightness and the radar, and then suddenly it changes, meaning it's not pointed at Earth anymore. Something's wrong. Its altitude has been, you know, 31,163, whatever it is, for the past 10 years, and now it isn't. Now it's about 10% different. You know, there's little things like that, which, you know, I guess by inspection, you could figure that out on your own, except if you got 40,000 objects out there, you need a computer to do that for you. Yeah. So all those things kind of add up. And, you know, in the past, I've seen that, oh, look at this satellite's going nuts on me. And then I wait a few days later and then they announce, oh, yeah, I guess it went bad.
Okay. Anyone else with questions? Feel free to unmute yourself.
How do you...
One of you can talk.
Hello.
Yeah. How do you access the SWAT tool? Is it online?
No. It's just my private thing. I'm thinking of marketing it. Now, I haven't played with it for 9 years. It's actually in Microsoft Access. So Access has a 2 gigabyte limit. So I'm thinking, oh, yeah, I probably should transfer it over to SQL Server. I need to team with some company who wants to market it. And then, you know, we could put this together for something either militarily or whatever. But there's another tool also called SIAM. And what it does is it, since space is information, it looks at the flow of information on the battlefield. And it doesn't care whether it comes from the space or comes from a UAV or whatever, but it looks at the value of the information sensor to shooter. And so it provides a combined targeting tool. Well, should I attack the satellite, the link, the ground thing, the link from the ground to the command center? And the reason I'm mentioning this is people love that tool so much. And this is like 20 years ago. The company I was working with made $5 million on it and giving it to, I forget, it was Boeing or something like that, that they installed it into a command and control system, you know, multi-million dollar ones. And then they come and cancel the command and control system and my software automatically just went away, you know. And it's the same with SWAT. People love it, but I haven't been able to. And, you know, just on a personal note, I'm a professional nerd. I'm not a salesman. So I always needed to team up with somebody who loves shaking hands. I love just sitting at my computer in the corner and being left alone. So maybe that's the issue. It certainly is a tool that has worked. It was used last about 10 years ago in a military exercise here at Air Force Research Labs. But they were lucky if they used 5% of it. You know, that U.S. Space Force doesn't really get it. They don't really know how to fight Space Wars. You know, I'm on the General Officer Steering Group for Air Force Research Lab. They're 2 or 3-star retired generals. They don't have the slightest idea how to fight Space Wars. And these are space generals who are in charge of tens of thousands of people and, you know, an actual astronaut and all that. They haven't really figured it out yet. And that's kind of my mission in life is, on class. I mean, all of this is doctrine, military doctrine, at least in the United States, is unclass because you've got to teach all your soldiers that and stuff like that. And so that's why, you know, I kind of understand where the skeletons are buried because I've worked that. But I'm really talking about the doctrine. And I mentioned earlier, situational awareness is everything. And so you really need to know what's happening in space, be able to verify it. Really quick, or you're just going to lose. And it doesn't matter what great gear you might have, and you get too easily enamored with the bells and whistles, but it's how you use it and your brain and your guts too, I guess, when it comes to war.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And by the way, if you'd ask me, connecting SWAT to SDK might be interesting. Because then,
well, right now it's automatically connected to SOAP, Satellite Orbit Analysis Package. The other thing I didn't mention, I have a whole SWAT briefing if you want. It has the whole space catalog database in it with pictures of satellite characteristics. And that's what's used to generate unclassified space scenarios using random number generators and things like that. I'm sorry, what was the question again? The statement?
Oh, it wasn't a question. I was just saying that you can connect it to SDK, to the satellite toolkit.
So and the SWAT thing is connected to SOAP, but you can go to SDK. SOAP was free to me. You can search and say, show me all Chinese imagery satellites that are live. And then you click on those and you say, okay, show me the orbits. And boom, there are the orbits. So, you know, it's an analytic tool beyond that to really understand the space situation. And I'm not saying this is the end to it all. It's very difficult to understand intention in space. This is just one tool. There's a lot of other tools. Just use them all, you know, to my mind. And you might just find that secret little nugget that's going to help you understand all the mystery that's happening in space. And like I say, governments love mystery. Been about 10 space wars since the 1970s. You're going to see more of it. You're going to see probably more of it over the Ukrainian thing. So it'd probably be good to get ahead of it. And like I say, put together your own space network, sensor network. You know, I've been inside the Cheyenne Mountain Complex several times, you know, Colorado Springs, a big mountain, nuclear proof. And I remember one place at the Space Surveillance Center, little yellow stickies saying, don't track this satellite, don't track that one. And so, yeah, I've got this unclassified catalog. It's not showing everything. Of course, if there was other inputs from another country, you can go in there, yeah. They're always trying to hide things, even illegally from the UN, I guess, if they're not tracking certain objects. But I used to have the SCI catalog, and it didn't really seem to make much of a difference, quite frankly, with the SWAT calculations. You know, I used to do it for the Air Force 10 years ago.
Guys and girls, any other questions?
I know there usually aren't too many questions. It's like beyond people's experience, I guess.
Oh, there's a question in the chat. Yair is asking regarding attacking space assets as part of a space warfare. How do you deal with commercial satellites of a third party that sells services to the red side?
Yeah, I'm surprised Russia hasn't attacked SpaceX. Who are some of the imagery satellites, Maxar, because they're part of the kill chain. You know, the imagery satellite is saying, oh, here's Russian forces, here's Russian tanks. And then the SpaceX is communicating that information to the forces and they send a missile over and kill Russians. So I think it's kind of childish, Elon Musk saying, oh, I'm going to play this war game, you know, and not believe that you're going to come under attack. And have you checked with your insurance carriers too? You know, and I think Russia hasn't wanted to escalate to space yet because they're vulnerable too, and maybe they won't. But I think it's kind of foolish. And I've said this for years before this war even started. The drones that used to fly in Afghanistan and Iraq for the United States, they were controlled at Creech Air Force Base, still are, I guess, outside Las Vegas, Nevada, in the United States. And how are they controlled? Well, by satellite. You got to bounce a signal up to get to this drone flying around random places. At least a few years ago, they were using Intelsat, International Telecommunication Satellite, I don't know, 50 or 60 countries own. And, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but it seems to me, okay, this Intelsat is part of the kill chain. You are actually killing people on the ground. Does that mean a satellite control center in France that's controlling Intelsat is a legal target? You know, now I don't know if people thought all this through. And okay, the Russians destroyed a bunch of Viasat modems in Europe. And so that's a physical attack, I guess. It's sort of like the cyber is acceptable, especially since you can't prove in a court of law that they actually did it. I mean, it's obvious who else would have. And that's why I think people love cyber weapons for space.
Cyber, I think, is like a soft kill. So
yeah, and then let me tell you another thought experiment. You're a soldier in the trenches, and you hear the enemy's tanks revving up, coming to attack, and this crazy scientist, mad scientist, comes into your trench and he says, oh, look at this black box I got with this big red button on it. If you push that button, it'll cyber attack those tanks. And I assure you, it'll stop. It worked in the lab, you know, I assure you. However, we can only afford this cyber weapon. We couldn't afford the bazookas that you normally would have. Good luck, you know. And so the tanks are coming at them. They pushed a button. The, you know, the tank stops and 30 seconds later reboots and comes and squishes you. Now, I don't know about you guys, but it's more emotionally satisfying to see a burning hole in the ground where the tank used to be versus a cyber weapon, you know. So, yeah, go ahead, play with your cyber weapons and all that. And, oh, maybe that works against second and third world countries. But a pure adversary, they aren't dummies. And they're going to fake their death. How do you validate it? And I've been to space cyber exercises with the actual cyber warriors, and they get fooled real easily. So great, have fun with that. It's sort of like PSYOPs, you know, World War II, changing the directions of the street signs and stuff like that. You know, it's helpful, but I don't think it wins wars. And so at lower level conflicts, yeah. Now, there's plenty of techniques. There are cyber techniques to kill things without debris. I mean, I've just come up with, well, 90 of them. I have a whole briefing on that. That, let's say you just made the satellite start spin crazy. It'll take them days to figure it out. You can make it spin enough, parts will start flying off. You could make it use up all its fuel. You could make its sensor point towards the sun, maybe, and burn out its, you know, photomultiplier, whatever they're using, CCDs. I mean, there's ways, I'm sure you can kind of do that. And you could measure, I guess, the effectiveness of the, I don't know if you could measure if it burned out his optics train, especially if he had shutters and stuff. But at any rate, they certainly love playing with that. They certainly somehow attacked the GLONASS satellites. I don't know why, but the fact of the matter was, you know, suddenly they stopped being accurate. They were totally useless. Hopefully no airplane was trying to use them and all. So, you know, go ahead, do that, but you better have something in your back pocket. And think of combined arms. Okay, jam a satellite signal or cyber attack it or something like that, you know, jam it for 24 hours so the ground controllers can't configure a satellite into being reconfiguring to a self-defense mode, and sort of fix it in place where you bring up the real weapon. It might take 12 hours to get up there and to do the job right, a verifiable job. So, oh yeah, that sounds effective, kind of thing. So no, there's very many ways to be doing this. And these are clever people. The trouble is you have clever adversaries too. And, you know, I've heard stories, at least decades ago, the Russians had crappier computers, so they had better programmers who went into machine coding and stuff like that. And so are they better cyber warriors? I don't know. You know, the cultures are different, and you just can't assume they're just like us.
Yeah, I see that Avi raised his hand. Avi, do you want to ask something?
Yeah, good evening. So I wanted to ask, what are the possible scenarios during war on the ISS, on the International Space Station? Like, probably there is a Russian and American or European astronauts. So what are the possible scenarios in this case?
Okay, it's your fault. You asked an old man to tell stories. What? Any rate, I asked that very question of General Beer, B-E-E-R, probably in the 80s at a conference. He was a space general officer at a conference in Colorado Springs. And I says, you know, General, sir, if you had a Russian cosmonaut on the International Space Station, and he's, you know, got these binoculars and he's seeing the left hook, what would you do? Now, this guy, I'm sorry, he was a little crazy. He says, oh, I would just shoot him. Now, I don't know about shooting somebody on a space station and penetrating the holes in the thing and all that, but that was kind of the attitude then. So I don't know if nowadays you would just tie him up or if legally you could do that. You're right, that's an issue. What was it, last year or two ago? They found someone had drilled a hole in the space station, letting out oxygen.
Yeah.
And it never came out in this country, but the Russians claimed that some woman on there got lonely and wanted to come home. I don't know if that's true. So yeah, there's crazy things I'm sure that happen up there, though I would think there's a certain degree of camaraderie in a dangerous situation that they all, you know, try to watch out for each other. But, you know, this Russian anti-satellite test a few months back before February, where they took out one of their dead weather satellites, which to me implied they were threatening National Reconnaissance Office satellites in the same sun-synchronous orbit. And they had threatened GPS satellites a week later. To me, that indicated that they were going to go to war in Ukraine, because they were risking their cosmonauts, their own cosmonauts on the International Space Station with debris. The Russians were launching a new, I don't know, $100 million module to the space station a few months later, you know, but then they were willing to threaten it. Who knows the evil in men's souls? I don't know. That's what I'm talking about. Space is very political. You can't just mathematically figure it out on that. Though I think the fact that the U.S. attempted to take out the GLONASS, well, did take out the GLONASS satellite, maybe took out a bunch of other Russian satellites, and then the Russians attacked on the ground and deterred Obama from doing anything more. Probably, and then the Russians doing this attack against their own satellite to demonstrate their willingness to risk, probably created a deterrence environment, because I haven't detected any major attacks in space. Now, maybe they're happening and they're secretive and things like that. So maybe deterrence worked on that. And so you're getting again to this game of diplomacy, politics, intent, will. You know, the U.S. has dossiers on adversary commanders, you know, that what's their education and this and that. I mean, I've seen some pretty scary stuff. They're always trying to psych out the other guy and what do you think he will do and all that. And again, that's what war is all about. Not necessarily that this cool thing that you're attacking International Space Station with. And then are you willing to take the heat afterwards for killing all those people?
Yeah,
because you, even though you're maybe an evil country or something, you still have allies. And I don't know, you know, nobody's insanely dumb, I don't think.
Well, not sure about that. There are some crazy dudes out there. I think we have one last question in the chat. And okay. It is, if you can recommend, in addition to your LinkedIn group, if you can recommend any other international communities of interest that would be useful to join around this subject.
You know, I'm not aware of any more. I've been kind of a lonely voice in the wilderness here all my life, actually. And the only thing I can think of, I think it's in Germany, there's some sort of astronomers group that loves taking these commercial telescopes, civil telescopes, and tracking space objects and trying to find secret satellites, though I think it's run by Russia, at least years ago. So they're sort of playing that game.
A bunch of them. I remember when Trump tweeted the image of the Iranian launch site that failed to launch. A bunch of them, from looking at the image and looking at the angle of the sun and stuff like that, managed to understand which satellite took the image. That
Oh really?
Trump,
oh, okay.
That Trump tweeted.
And there's certainly a whole group of various people who love looking at the imagery, the satellite imagery, you know, news organizations too, of Ukraine and trying to figure out what's happening. I don't know anyone specifically, but I always hear on YouTube and all of these kinds of things.
Yeah, open source intelligence. That's
really yeah. And then right there's now. Things that for years, and I'm sorry, I'm an old man. I'm not remembering. I'm 71 years old and might not look it. It there's these websites that, you know, are always talking about unclassified documents, and there's some good information I've gotten out of them. I forget the names and stuff like that, though I don't recall any of them having particularly space emphasis. And I think there, now I remember there's Gunther's website, space site, something like that, who, you know, does a lot of work looking at individual satellites and everything he can figure out. Now, I don't know if he's got anything on NRO birds and all. You know, National Reconnaissance Office people thought of themselves as very important, but they were the shaft of the spear. I've worked on the spear pointy, you know, the sharp point.
Yeah.
And so there's worlds beyond them. And like I said, we used to wrap our lunches in the NRO documents. So you might play that game, but they're not really in the game, let's say. There's a whole other things. And okay, let me do an assessment. In my personal opinion, who's top in space warfare in the world? So United States, yeah. It used to be Russia. I think it's more China, number two. Russia, number three. India. I mean, they did a direct-to-send ASAT. Obviously, they got intent. That's all I know about it.
Yeah.
But, you know, and it doesn't take much to have a laser like I have to blind satellites. You know, yeah, you need a more powerful laser, and you need to be able to get a return to see if you really hit it. And you need to understand where the satellite really is at, and maybe a little bit of its optics train and stuff like that. Any country has clever programmers, hackers, if you want to do the cyber routine, maybe even buy it. There's, I think, three different companies that have these maintenance refueling satellites. Seems to me you can buy one of those and put extra stuff on it, you know, and suddenly you got ASAT. So anyway, U.S., China, Russia, India, maybe France, you know, because again, I don't know specifically, but they told me about their mobile laser blinder, and they have that. They probably have satellite jammers and all, and who knows what else. And I bet you Israel, you know, I have no knowledge of that, but yeah, they probably do.
Our lips are sealed.
Yeah, no, I understand. Now, if you want, I can help them fight and win space wars. Hire me as a consultant.
Well, some of them, I think, were here today, maybe, I don't know, and heard you. If anybody reaches out to me, then I will direct them to you if they don't reach out to you personally.
Right, and you know, I'm willing to give this briefing again, maybe the two-hour version. My other versions on space weapons, escalation control, things like that, you know, via Zoom, or if you want to pay for my way to come to Israel, whatever, I'll do that. I'll do that free once, and then, you know, we can maybe get into some sort of business deal.
Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing if anybody here heard and wants, they know how to reach out to you, straight to you or through me. Paul Szymanski, thank you very, very, very much. This was very interesting. Unique. It's the first talk that I have on my podcast about this subject, which is a very interesting subject that is usually in the shadows, or I don't know.
No pun intended, in the cold.
Yeah, in the dark. So thank you very much for your time. If anybody wants to thank Paul, you can unmute your mics and thank him. And I will send you the link to the podcast when it's ready.
Yeah, that'd be good. I like to see the link too. I just put in my database of 110 things I've done.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Right. Okay, I'm signing off, right?
Thanks, Paul. Bye-bye.
Let's see. Bye now. Have a good evening, I guess.
Bye, thank you.
Yeah.